it started to seem to me within the last few years that the internet itself is especially, it's sort of like an engine of self-delusion. It's sort of like a machine that produces it. And I was interested in that, and I was sort of tracking that relationship throughout all these different topics.
That was Gia Tolentino talking about her book, Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. Gia is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Previously, she was the deputy editor at Jezebel and a contributing editor at The Hairpin. She grew up in Texas, attended the University of Virginia, served in the Peace Corps in Kurdistan, and received an MFA in fiction from the University of Michigan. Most importantly, Gia is our guest today on The Source, Quill and Scroll's podcast. She is also a visiting writer-in-residence for the University of Iowa's Magid Center. I'm your host, Nicole Shaw, and we're recording from the legendary Dye House at the University of Iowa, home to the renowned Iowa Writers' Workshop. Thank you for joining us today, Gia.
Happy to join you.
Yeah, thanks, really appreciate it. We're super excited to meet with you and just pick your brain about your experiences thus far. I'm so glad you're here with us at Quill and Scroll to connect with high school journalists around the world. To start off, can you start by elaborating on your statement that the internet is an engine of self-delusion? What do you mean exactly by that? Are you talking about social media or just online information in general?
The internet is increasingly structured around social media platforms, which are essentially structured around positioning everyone's personal identity as the effective center of the universe. And it's sort of, there's a way in which the internet via social media routes all information through identity, right? It encourages you to post things insofar as they reflect on you and insofar as they reflect what you are trying to project. And I think that the fact that, you know, to some degree, this is kind of a natural process. We perceive the world through our own personal lenses naturally. But the way that this is systematized and monetized by the internet, I think, as we've all seen within the last few years, leads to a mass sense of, you know, delusion.
For sure. And I think thinking about identity too, it reminds me actually of the picture of Dorian Gray, that novel, and just the image of self and kind of grappling with that, especially and just in general, looking at your identity and kind of who you want to be. It's a lot of overload, especially with technology and social media. And I also know, like, particularly for journalists, I mean, you're a journalist as well, and part of your job is to be on, you know, social media, Twitter, to see what's happening. And so could you just speak a little bit about that, kind of balancing your role as a journalist on social media, but also as a person with an individual identity and trying to balance that relationship?
I try to limit my time on social media. I have it blocked off my phone after a certain point at night and before a certain point in the morning to avoid the feeling of going to bed scrolling and waking up scrolling, which I find, you know, like, whenever I'm on my deathbed, I anticipate looking back and regretting every single second I spent scrolling, you know, as soon as I woke up and as soon as before I went to bed, which is really easy to do. I find it impossible to refrain from doing that unless I have it formally blocked. It's the problem with writing about the internet and writing about how the internet is destructive. It means that you have to keep tabs on all the way that the internet is destructive. Like, I think increasingly this idea of digital detoxing, it's possible to some degree for everyone, but, you know, a full withdrawal is increasingly obvious as a privilege, right? I find it important to sort of be in it to understand what these biggest companies of this era, how these systems are evolving and what incentives they're creating. I have a sort of reputation as someone that's very, very online because I write about the internet, but I tweet once every like 3 days. Mm-hmm. You know, I try not to, as I was writing about in my book, you know, I think that the act of expressing your own opinion on the internet makes it seem really important, but it's really not, you know, it's really not important at all. And, or at least in the individual sense, in the collective sense, absolutely. I don't really vocalize my own opinions on it very much anymore.
And I think that's also just has to do probably with the fact that the internet moves so fast. So it's like, how important is this one tweet that I send out going to, like, leave a legacy or something like that?
Yeah, and I think that unimportant, like, that's actually what I like about Twitter. Like, Yeah. Like it's much more fun when people use it understanding that it's stupid than when people use it trying to, you know, like, with this grand sense of self-importance. It really, those kinds of tweets really show you how useless the whole thing is.
For sure. And I want to circle back to your roots. You were raised in Houston, Texas, and attended a megachurch and a Christian high school there. How did that experience shape you?
In a lot of ways.
I can imagine.
I was in a megachurch school for 12 years. I think mostly what it made me the most, I mean, I could talk about this for several hours, but the most lasting thing in terms of journalism is that I'm extremely comfortable when people disagree with me. I'm very, very far to the left. I wasn't really in high school, but I was still much further to the left than everyone around me. And I just became really comfortable with being in an environment where every single person disagreed with what I thought about the world. Of course, it bothers me. There were a lot of things about conservative politics in Texas that really, really, really bothered me. But in terms of getting comfortable with disagreement, which I think is necessary if you're a journalist, that was great training.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up journalism in high school and how that really just prepared you, because I was interested if you were involved in journalism back then, or was that just a passion developed later and went on to eventually take your path to New
York? I actually was a member of Quill and Scroll. I was the editor of the yearbook. And I guess it was good training, but my high school didn't have a newspaper, didn't have a magazine. I didn't write for the newspaper in college, didn't write for anything. I was not very pre-professional. I never thought that I was going to end up being a writer. So I've never really thought about my life in terms of career.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. So I was reading one of your past interviews, and you said that you didn't really address yourself or think of yourself as a writer until you were already a writer for about a year.
Yeah, until I was getting paid to do it for about a year. Because, I don't know, I think when I was growing up, I didn't know anybody that was a writer. It didn't seem like an accessible pathway to me. I didn't understand how anybody got into media. I didn't understand how anyone ever published books for a living, which, to be honest, it's most people don't publish books for a living. You have to do other things for a living, and then you get to publish books on the side. So yeah, I never really thought about it, because, you know, the identity of being a writer is basically useless. Like, I have no use for the idea of being a writer. What I have use for is just the practice of writing.
Just to switch in topic a little bit, our listeners are hearing a song that you're very familiar with, Ballet Statique, by German experimental musician Konrad Schnitzler. You say that it helps you feel reassured as you write. Why is it that particular song that really helps you set the mood for your writing?
Well, I used to listen to music constantly while I was writing. I used to be able to listen to everything. I used to be able to listen to really wordy music. I used to listen to a lot of rap when I was working. And then a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I stopped being able to listen to music with words while I was writing, which I find it really awful. You know, I miss, my days are a lot less colorful now because often I have to work in silence, and I really don't like that. But the kind of music that I can still always work to, I can work to jazz, and I can work to kind of mathy, minimalist stuff like this song. And there's something about, and there are some songs, another one is the Tok Tok album, Spirit of Eden. There's some albums and some songs that sound like thinking, that sound like what it feels like to have a new thought. And this song kind of feels like it. The way it iterates makes me feel like what it feels like when your brain's working, which isn't always, you know.
Are there any specific moments when a story you've read inspired you to write a story of your own that was received well?
In terms of learning what chemistry you have with what subject, I mean, I really choose what to write about based on how strong my reaction to is it. And if I have a strong reaction to it, then it seems like something that's worth writing about. If it's something that you would talk about on your own time with a friend, then it seems like, you know, it's like something has to pass that real life test. It has to occupy your attention in the real world. It can't just be something that you're generating interest for on the page. It has to be something that you are interested enough in to talk your friend's ear off about it.
2 years ago, in a first-person article for The New Yorker, you were one of the first journalists to write about the vaping crisis. You also interviewed a lot of high school students for that story.
That was the funnest story.
So how important was it for you to actually buy a vape pen and cartridge and partake? And then second, what did you learn about high school students that you didn't know before you began reporting on them?
One of the most clear ways of experiencing a phenomenon is to experience it, right? Like, one thing that's great about reporting is you can talk to people, you can get a bunch of different stories, but there's no authority. I mean, I really trust my own instincts in a way that I you know, don't trust anything else. And, you know, with something like if it's a story about what is vaping, it's like, you got to do it. I mean, it's so much, you know, there's no reason not to. There's no reason. But also that's kind of like one of the reasons I was drawn to journalism. It's an excuse to see something from the inside. And that seems like a really fun way to experience the world. One of the reasons I really wanted to do that story is because, you know, it drives me nuts when high school and college students are written about like they're stupid, you know? There's this way that the media often really condescends to, you know, or makes any sort of high school trend into this sort of, like, you know, we all saw it with the vaping thing. Yeah. It was like, oh, these children are addicted to nicotine, you know? Like,
how could they do this?
Like, yeah, and it's like, have you not been a teenager? Yeah, and I was like, also, hello, like, when I was in high school, all I wanted to do was stuff that was stupid and physically self-destructive in a mild way, because I was young and you feel like you're going to live forever and it doesn't matter.
We've all been there.
And I, like, you know, to some degree still kind of am like that. And anyway, and it's like that whenever people write in a condescending way about some young person phenomenon, like about college activism, really drives me nuts. And it makes me want to, you know, or about the conversation about consent or something, you know, people underestimate the degree to which young people, especially young people right now, like, have a far better grasp on the situation than anyone else does, and like have a sense of irony about it and kind of understand the narratives at play. I don't think that anything really surprised me about talking to high school students, because I try to do that as often as possible. I've, you know, tried to work with high school students whenever I can, and I kind of, you know, already knew that they were smart and knew the deal and were super funny and, you know, fun to talk to. But it was fun to put that on the page for an audience like the New Yorker's audience.
Yeah, and I think a younger audience like that just has a very uninhibited viewpoint, very authentic and transparent, I think, because they'll just tell you like it is, at least in my experience of working with them.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I think it's a really great point, too, that you bring up the activism that they do and how important that is and how engaged they are with things happening in our world today. You've written quite extensively about the Me Too movement and the Harvey Weinstein trial. How important has that work been for you?
This is one of the most like era-defining shifts, you know, that is happening. I try not to think about my work in terms of, I try not to presume that it will do any good for anyone. You know, if I'm lucky, then it will. But I can't think about that. I've never been able to think about that. The way it's important to me is much more internal. It's much more, you know, when everyone is talking about something, can you say something new? Can you say something that's just under the surface that no one's articulated exactly that way yet? It's sort of an internal pursuit of trying to make sense out of it for myself more than anything, because this is a really confusing time. And even to make sense out of feeling sick of it, right? To make sense out of feeling like oversaturated by something that's so important, that even like that reflex is something that I've written about. I'm always trying to find ways to, you know, not be too neat and tidy about things.
I read with interest your critique of the Netflix documentary series Cheer. I was into competitive cheer from a young age, and I still bear the scars from it, both physical and emotional. You write that you were a cheerleader in your high school days. How has Netflix done representing accurately the culture of cheerleading in the American South, and specifically in Texas?
Well, what I was doing was nothing like what that team was doing. I was nowhere near that level. I don't think that show is trying to represent the culture of cheerleading. I think it was a documentary about one team at one moment, right? But I think that there are a lot of things about cheerleading that show expressed in a way that nothing really has before, just in terms of the physical punitiveness of it and the real, just the athleticism of it. And also, yeah, how far, you know, how different competitive cheerleading is from game day sideline cheerleading. And I think because there's no reason why anyone would ever know what competitive cheerleading is like. You know, as Cheer showed, you can't even stream the national competition. Like, that's one of the things that I found so magical about that show, is that there's this real pathos about it, right? Because I mean, nobody cares about competitive cheerleading other than competitive cheerleaders. Yeah. And, you know, and there's something really heartbreaking and there's something really kind of pure and wonderful about it, right? It's like people pursuing these impossible things for no reason, just because it feels, you know, and like I remember that feeling of what it's like to be able to do something just really, really wild with mm-hmm. like three bodies, you yeah. know? I think that it did really a really good job of that.
Yeah, I think that series, I watched it with my roommate who also did competitive cheer with me for like 15 years. Mm. We're both competitive cheerleaders. I went to Worlds. It was like, I was very invested in the cheer world.
Yeah.
And so being able to watch that, they did a fantastic job storytelling because I was like right there with them.
Totally.
Remembering all those injuries and mm-hmm. just how that felt during that time. But yeah, I think they did a fantastic job at being able to tell a story through all of the different narratives that each teammate had. Mm-hmm. I have one last really quick question. What would high school Gia say about what 30-something Gia has done with her career thus far?
I think she would say, good for you. Yeah.
We love to hear it. I mean, yeah. that's what we hope we hear.
Yeah.
That's unfortunately all the time we have today for this episode of The Source, Quill and Scrolls podcast. Gia, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No problem. Until next time, this is Nicole Shaw signing off. And remember, all around you, there are stories to be told.